Chapter 9. It was thirst that woke him. He had slept warm, though his clothes were damp, and found himself lying in sunlight, the blue waterfall at his side dancing and coruscating with every transparent shade in the whole gamut of blue, and flinging strange lights far up to the underside of the forest leaves. The realization of his position, as it rolled heavily back upon consciousness, was unbearable. If only he hadn't lost his nerve, the Sorns would have killed him by now. Then he remembered with inexpressible relief that there was a man wandering in the wood. Poor devil, he'd be glad to see him. He would come up to him and say, "Hello, Ransom." He stopped, puzzled. No, it was only himself. It was Ransom. Or was he? Who was the man whom he had led to a hot stream and tucked up in bed, telling him not to drink the strange water? Obviously, some newcomer who didn't know the place as well as he. But whatever Ransom had told him, he was going to drink now. He lay down on the bank and plunged his face in the warm, rushing liquid. It was good to drink. It had a strong mineral flavour, but it was very good. He drank again and found himself greatly refreshed and steadied. All that about the other Ransom was nonsense. He was quite aware of the danger of madness and applied himself vigorously to his devotions and his toilet. Not that madness mattered much. Perhaps he was mad already, and not really on Malacandra, but safe in bed in an English asylum. If only it might be so. He would ask Ransom. Curse it. There his mind went playing the same trick again. He rose and began walking briskly away. The delusions recurred every few minutes as long as this stage of his journey lasted. He learned to stand still, mentally, as it were, and let them roll over his mind. It was no good bothering about them. When they were gone, you could resume sanity again. Far more important was the problem of food. He tried one of the trees with his knife. As he expected, it was toughly soft like a vegetable, not hard like wood. He cut a little piece out of it, and under this operation, the whole gigantic organism vibrated to its top. It was like being able to shake the mast of a full-rigged ship with one hand. When he put it in his mouth, he found it almost tasteless, but by no means disagreeable, and for some minutes he munched away contentedly. But he made no progress. The stuff was quite unswallowable, and could only be used as chewing gum. As such, he used it, and after it many other pieces, not without some comfort. It was impossible to continue yesterday's flight as a flight. Inevitably, it degenerated into an endless ramble, vaguely motivated by the search for food. The search was necessarily vague, since he did not know whether Malacandra held food for him, nor how to recognize it if it did. He had one bad fright in the course of the morning, when, passing through a somewhat more open glade, he became aware first of a huge yellow object, then of two, then of an indefinite multitude coming towards him. Before he could fly, he found himself in the midst of a herd of enormous, pale, furry creatures, more like giraffes than anything else he could think of, except that they could and did raise themselves on their hind legs and even progress several paces in that position. They were slenderer and very much higher than giraffes, and were eating the leaves off the tops of the purple plants. They saw him and stared at him with their big liquid eyes, snorting in basso profondissimo, but had apparently no hostile intentions. Their appetite was voracious. In 5 minutes they had mutilated the tops of a few hundred trees and admitted a new flood of sunlight into the forest. Then they passed on. This episode had an infinitely comforting effect on Ransom. The planet was not, as he had begun to fear, lifeless except for Sorns. Here was a very presentable sort of animal, an animal which man could probably tame, and whose food man could possibly share. If only it were possible to climb the trees. He was staring about him with some idea of attempting this feat, when he noticed that the devastation wrought by the leaf-eating animals had opened a vista overhead beyond the plant tops to a collection of the same greenish-white objects which he had seen across the lake at their first landing. This time they were much closer. They were enormously high, so that he had to throw back his head to see the top of them. They were something like pylons in shape, but solid, irregular in height, and grouped in an apparently haphazard and disorderly fashion. Some ended in points that looked from where he stood as sharp as needles, while others, after narrowing towards the summit, expanded again into knobs or platforms that seemed to his terrestrial eyes ready to fall at any moment. He noticed that the sides were rougher and more seamed with fissures than he had realized at first, and between two of them he saw a motionless line of twisting blue brightness, obviously a distant fall of water. It was this which finally convinced him that the things, in spite of their improbable shape, were mountains. And with that discovery, the mere oddity of the prospect was swallowed up in the fantastic sublime. Here, he understood, was the full statement of that perpendicular theme which beast and plant and earth all played on Malacandra. Here, in this riot of rock, leaping and surging skyward like solid jets from some rock fountain, and hanging by their own lightness in the air, so shaped, so elongated, that all terrestrial mountains must ever after seem to him to be mountains lying on their sides. He felt a lift and lightening at the heart. But the next moment his heart stood still. Against the pallid background of the mountains, and quite close to him, for the mountains themselves seemed but a quarter of a mile away, a moving shape appeared. He recognized it instantly as it moved slowly, and, he thought, stealthily, between two of the denuded plant-tops. The giant stature, the cadaverous leanness, the long, drooping, wizard-like profile of a Sorn. The head appeared to be narrow and conical. The hands or paws with which it parted the stems before it as it moved were thin, mobile, spidery, and almost transparent. He felt an immediate certainty that it was looking for him. All this he took in an infinitesimal time. The ineffaceable image was hardly stamped on his brain before he was running as hard as he could into the thickest of the forest. He had no plan save to put as many miles as he could between himself and the Sorn. He prayed fervently that there might be only one. Perhaps the wood was full of them. Perhaps they had the intelligence to make a circle round him. No matter. There was nothing for it now but sheer running, running knife in hand. The fear had all gone into action. Emotionally he was cool and alert, and ready as he ever would be, for the last trial. His flight led him downhill at an ever-increasing speed. Soon the incline was so steep that if his body had had terrestrial gravity, he would have been compelled to take to his hands and knees and clamber down. Then he saw something gleaming ahead of him. A minute later he had emerged from the wood altogether. He was standing, blinking in the light of sun and water, on the shore of a broad river, and looking out on a flat landscape of intermingled river, lake, island, and promontory, the same sort of country on which his eyes had first rested in Malacandra. There was no sound of pursuit. Ransom dropped down on his stomach and drank, cursing a world where cold water appeared to be unobtainable. Then he lay still to listen and to recover his breath. His eyes were upon the blue water. It was agitated. Circles shuddered and bubbles danced 10 yards away from his face. Suddenly the water heaved, and a round, shining black thing like a cannonball came into sight. Then he saw eyes and mouth, a puffing mouth bearded with bubbles. More of the thing came up out of the water. It was gleaming black. Finally it splashed and wallowed to the shore and rose, steaming, on its hind legs, 6 or 7 feet high and too thin for its height, like everything in Malacandra. It had a coat of thick black hair, lucid as sealskin, very short legs with webbed feet, a broad beaver-like or fish-like tail, strong forelimbs with webbed claws or fingers, and some complication halfway up the belly which Ransom took to be its genitals. It was something like a penguin, something like an otter, something like a seal. The slenderness and flexibility of the body suggested a giant stoat. The great round head, heavily whiskered, was mainly responsible for the suggestion of seal, but it was higher in the forehead than a seal's, and the mouth was smaller. There comes a point at which the actions of fear and precaution are purely conventional, no longer felt as terror or hope by the fugitive. Ransom lay perfectly still, pressing his body as well down into the weed as he could, in obedience to a wholly theoretical idea that he might thus pass unobserved. He felt little emotion. He noted, in a dry, objective way, that this was apparently to be the end of his story, caught between a Sorn from the land and a big black animal from the water. He had, it is true, a vague notion that the jaws and mouth of the beast were not those of a carnivore, but he knew that he was too ignorant of zoology to do more than guess. Then something happened which completely altered his state of mind. The creature, which was still steaming and shaking itself on the back and had obviously not seen him, opened its mouth and began to make noises. This in itself was not remarkable, but a lifetime of linguistic study assured Ransom almost at once that these were articulate noises. The creature was talking. It had a language. If you are not yourself a philologist, I am afraid you must take on trust the prodigious emotional consequences of this realization in Ransom's mind. A new world he had already seen, but a new, an extraterrestrial, a non-human language was a different matter. Somehow he had not thought of this in connection with the Sorns. Now it flashed upon him like a revelation. The love of knowledge is a kind of madness. In the fraction of a second which it took Ransom to decide that the creature was really talking, and while he still knew that he might be facing instant death, his imagination had leaped over every fear and hope and probability of his situation to follow the dazzling prospect of making a Malachandrian grammar. An introduction to the Malachandrian language, the lunar verb, a concise Martian English dictionary. The titles flitted through his mind. And what might one not discover from the speech of a non-human race? The very form of language itself, the principle behind all possible languages, might fall into his hands. Unconsciously he raised himself on his elbow and stared at the black beast. It became silent. The huge bullet head swung round and lustrous amber eyes fixed him. There was no wind on the lake or in the wood. Minute after minute, in utter silence, the representatives of two so far divided species stared each into the other's face. Ransom rose to his knees. The creature leaped back, watching him intently, and they became motionless again. Then it came a pace nearer, and Ransom jumped up and retreated, but not far. Curiosity held him. He summoned up his courage and advanced, holding out his hand. The beast misunderstood the gesture. It backed into the shallows of the lake, and he could see the muscles tightened under its sleek pelt, ready for sudden movement. But there it stopped. It, too, was in the grip of curiosity. Neither dared let the other approach, yet each repeatedly felt the impulse to do so himself, and yielded to it. It was foolish, frightening, ecstatic, and unbearable all in one moment. It was more than curiosity. It was like a courtship, like the meeting of the first man and the first woman in the world. It was like something beyond that. So natural is the contact of sexes, so limited the strangeness, so shallow the reticence, so mild the repugnance to be overcome, compared with the first tingling intercourse of two different but rational species. The creature suddenly turned and began walking away. A disappointment like despair smote Ransom. "Come back!" he shouted in English. The thing turned, spread out its arms, and spoke again in its unintelligible language. Then it resumed its progress. It had not gone more than 20 yards away when Ransom saw it stoop down and pick something up. It returned. In its hand, he was already thinking of its webbed forepaw as a hand, it was carrying what appeared to be a shell, the shell of some oyster-like creature, but rounder and more deeply domed. It dipped the shell in the lake and raised it full of water. Then it held the shell to its own middle and seemed to be pouring something into the water. Ransom thought with disgust that it was urinating in the shell. Then he realized that the protuberances on the creature's belly were not genital organs, nor organs at all. It was wearing a kind of girdle hung with various pouch-like objects, and it was adding a few drops of liquid from one of these to the water in the shell. This done, it raised the shell to its black lips and drank, not throwing back its head like a man, but bowing it and sucking like a horse. When it had finished, it refilled the shell and once again added a few drops from the receptacle. It seemed to be some kind of skin bottle at its waist. Supporting the shell in its two arms, it extended them towards Ransom. The intention was unmistakable. Hesitantly, almost shyly, he advanced and took the cup. His fingertips touched the webbed membrane of the creature's paws, and an indescribable thrill of mingled attraction and repulsion ran through him. Then he drank. Whatever had been added to the water was plainly alcoholic. He had never enjoyed a drink so much. "Thank you," he said in English. "Thank you very much." The creature struck itself on the chest and made a noise. Ransom did not at first realize what it meant. Then he saw that it was trying to teach him its name, presumably the name of the species. "Hross," it said. "Hross," and flapped itself. "Hross," repeated Ransom, and pointed at it, then "man," and struck his own chest. "Hma, hma, hman," imitated the hross. It picked up a handful of earth, where earth appeared between weed and water at the bank of the lake. "Chandra," it said. Ransom repeated the word. Then an idea occurred to him. Malakandra? He said in an inquiring voice. The cross rolled its eyes and waved its arms, obviously in an effort to indicate the whole landscape. Ransom was getting on well. Khandra was earth, the element. Malakandra, the earth or planet as a whole. Soon he would find out what Malak meant. In the meantime, H disappears after C, he noted, and made his first step in Malakandrian phonetics. The cross was now trying to teach him the meaning of Handramit. He recognized the root Khandra again, and noted they have suffixes as well as prefixes. But this time he could make nothing of the cross's gestures, and remained ignorant what a Handramit might be. He took the initiative by opening his mouth, pointing to it, and going through the pantomime of eating. The Malakandrian word for food, or eat, which he got in return, proved to contain consonants unreproducible by a human mouth, and Ransom, continuing the pantomime, tried to explain that his interest was practical as well as philological. The cross understood him, though he took some time to understand from its gestures that it was inviting him to follow it. In the end, he did so. It took him only as far as where it had got the shell, and here, to his not very reasonable astonishment, Ransom found that a kind of boat was moored. Manlike, when he saw the artifact, he felt more certain of the cross's rationality. He even valued the creature the more because the boat, allowing for the usual Malakandrian height and flimsiness, was really very like an earthly boat. Only later did he set himself the question, what else could a boat be like? The cross produced an oval platter of some tough but slightly flexible material, covered it with strips of spongy orange-coloured substance, and gave it to Ransom. He cut a convenient length off with his knife and began to eat, doubtfully at first, and then ravenously. It had a bean-like taste, but sweeter. Good enough for a starving man. Then, as his hunger ebbed, the sense of his situation returned with dismaying force. The huge, seal-like creature seated beside him became unbearably ominous. It seemed friendly, but it was very big, very black, and he knew nothing at all about it. What were its relations to the Sorns, and was it really as rational as it appeared? It was only many days later that Ransom discovered how to deal with these sudden losses of confidence. They arose when the rationality of the cross tempted you to think of it as a man. Then it became abominable, a man 7 feet high with a snaky body, covered face and all with thick black animal hair and whiskered like a cat. But starting from the other end, you had an animal with everything an animal ought to have, glossy coat, liquid eyes, sweet breath and whitest teeth, and added to all these, as though paradise had never been lost and earliest dreams were true, the charm of speech and reason. Nothing could be more disgusting than the one impression, nothing more delightful than the other. It all depended on the point of view.